Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
So many young chefs, including myself, are told to replicate the food, to produce, and that's it. People should be told on how to create and how to think differently out of the box.
This week, we are delighted to have with us pioneering pastry chef and provocative food thinker, Dominique Ancel.
We created this hot chocolate with the marshmallow flour, where when you drop the marshmallow in the hot chocolate, it opens up and blossoms like a flower.
Dominique first started learning his craft in his native France when he was 16. He rose to become the head of the pastry department, the legendary Paris food emporium, Fauchon. Dominique then came to America at the invitation of the great French chef restaurateur Daniel Boulou. He opened his first eponymous bakery in 2011. Which is where he came up with the now legendary Cronut in May of 2013. The Cronut is, of course, a combination of a croissant and a donut that has achieved iconic status in pastry circles all over the world. Welcome to Special Sauce, Dominique. What a pleasure to have you here, and happy almost third birthday to the Cronut.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me today.
Oh, please. You know, we always have a great time talking about food, and you've even forgiven me for the time I tried to get you to make a cronut-like thing out of one of our advertisers' pastry dough, you know, and you didn't show just how annoyed and angry you must have been. So I appreciate
it. I always smile at you.
So, speaking of cronuts, we might as well deal with the elephant or the, maybe because it's a cronut, we should deal with the elephant ear in the room right away. Tell us about the origins of the cronut. What were you trying to do? Were you surprised about the intensity of the response?
Well, the way it started was very simple and very, very, very honest, I will say. At the bakery, when I first opened the bakery, I decided to change the menu. Every 6 to 8 weeks, I thought to myself that would be exciting for me, for my team, but also for my customers to create new dishes. This is what we've been doing since we opened the shop. And I remember like brainstorming with the team, one of those brainstorm sessions like we do every week, talking about what else we could do, what else would people be excited about. And someone had mentioned a donut. And I, you know, I took on the challenge. I was like, you know what, I'm French. I don't have any recipe for donut. But I'll come up with something, and I'll make something special. And this is where I created the cronut. We put it on the menu. And then Hugh from Grub Street came to the shop, took a photo, put it on his blog. Very simple, just a few lines. And the same afternoon, he actually called me and told me that the article went viral. And at this time, I still had no idea what he was talking about. And he told me they had an increase of traffic of 300% on their website and over 140,000 links to the same article within a couple hours.
Just from one photo of the
cronut. Just from one photo and one small article, just a few lines. And he told me, you know what, I think you should be ready for tomorrow because you're going to be busy. And in my mind, I was like, great, thank you. And, you know, I made 35, 40 the first day. I decided to make like 65 the next day because this is all what I could do. And by the third day, we had over 100 people waiting outside.
When you opened the doors?
Before we opened the doors.
Oh, my God.
Before 8 o'clock, we had hundreds of people waiting outside. And, of course, like we were slammed and overwhelmed like right away. Our kitchen is very, very tiny. It's probably 8 feet by 10, no more than that. With a table inside, with the furniture inside, with the dishwasher inside. So it's really, really tiny. We can only like have two people working at the same time on this one table. So we did everything we could to, of course, make more, but there's so much we could do. At the time, we only had 4 employees working for me, 2 barista and 2 people in the kitchen. And that was it. That was the entire team. And we did our best to make sure that we serve our customers the best way we could every single day. Nowadays, we have between 100 to 120 people waiting outside every morning. We bring them fresh baked madeleines, hot chocolate. We have umbrellas for when it rains outside. We have hand warmers.
It's a happening. It's like a cronut event every morning.
Every day. It's a real experience. And I always put myself into my customer's shoes and to make sure that they have a good time while waiting in line, during the time they enter into the shop, while they're ordering. I want to make sure that they, you know, it's real customer service and not just ignoring people outside. Right after we launched the Cornet, we had people scalping the food. We had people getting in line, arguing. So very early on, like, we had to hire a security company just to maintain order on the street.
On the Cronuts.
On the Cronut line. Nowadays, it's a lot better. It's a lot smoother. It's really happy time. It's a place where people actually meet with each other in the line.
It's like the line at Shake Shack in Madison Square Park.
It's almost the same. We have people like that met in line. The people that went on a first date, we had marriage proposal.
That's
at the
great.
Bakery in line. The last one was just 2 weeks ago, and she said yes.
That's awesome.
We had people coming to buy Kona to propose their future wives. We've had a lot of happy, exciting moment. Time of like bonding experience where people meet in line and really connect with each other. So it's a lot more than just coming to buy food and wait in line.
Sure.
It's a real experience. We have a cappella singers for Christmas for them.
You have really singers?
Like,
you have
we hire a cappella singers for Christmas.
For Christmas carols.
Exactly.
I love that. Okay. But what's interesting to me is you trademarked it, but you haven't tried to cash in on the success of the Cronut. You open another bakery in New York, and you don't even make Cronuts there. You could have made a lot of money licensing the Cronut to any number of establishments, and yet you didn't.
I firmly believe that in creation and innovation, the trademark process of the Cronut was a protective matter.
A protective matter.
Actually, at the time, a lawyer was trademarking the name of the bakery. And she saw that, you know, that there was a very popular item. And she told me that to protect ourselves from big industrial company that will rip off small business owner, like, we should trademark it.
And, got it.
And that was it. You know, at the time, I wasn't sure. Like, I didn't know what she was really saying and what she was talking about. But I saw very quickly, very early on, that people were trying to cash on it.
You decided you didn't want to be the Cronut magnate.
I decided not to be because I believe in more than just one hit, one item. I believe that in creativity, I believe into like this world of like food that is more than just one thing. My dad used to work in a factory, and I don't ever want to work myself in a factory. I care for my product, I care for my customers, and I want to give them good things. It's not about cashing out, it's about every day when you wake up, and this is what I've been doing since I'm 16 years old.
Wow.
Every day when you wake up, you're passionate, you're dedicated into your job, into your craft, into the people you work with, into the people you cook for. And this dedication and passion, you can't buy it.
Well, you mentioned your dad. So let's talk about the Ancel family table, because you have alluded to that table being pretty empty sometimes. I mean, it was not so easy growing up.
That's right. I come from a very humble family. I'm the last of four child. My grandmother used to live with us. My cousin used to live with us. My dad used to work in a factory. My mom stayed home taking care of the kids. So we're relying on one salary of a factory worker, and it was not easy to get food at the end of the month. It was pretty tight, and I always remember, and this is what like pushed me to charity action into the city.
Charity. So you do a lot of charity.
We do a lot of charity. I've done a lot of events with City Harvest, a lot of different charity to fight against hunger in New York City. The first year we launched the Cronut, we raised over $100,000, and all went to charity to fight against hunger in New York City.
And yeah, you've donated Cronuts to my charity, the Association to Benefit Children.
Exactly, and we raised over $100,000 just auctioning off 24 Cronuts.
That's
so
great.
So people like really, I saw the passion and the dedication that people had for the Cronut, and it's good that to do something good that I could do. I could be here to do something good for
right.
people that need help. But, and we tend to forget, we're in a big city. New York City is a big city. There's a lot of food. There's a lot of wealthy people, but there's also people who are hungry. Yeah. Also, a lot of people that struggle every month,
and
that, every day to eat food.
And those people resonate. Their experience resonates with your experience growing up.
That's right. And, you know, like, I never forget. And
yeah.
I no one should ever forget where they're from and what they can do. And if it takes some extra effort, extra work to do something nice for the community and to help feeding people and families, I'm happy to do so.
And so was your mom a good cook?
My mom was a horrible cook.
Wait, that just ruined my entire narrative.
I know. People don't believe me. They think, oh, French mother, she'll be so, like, talented at cooking. She'll, like give you the passion. Like, she will, like, lead you to get started into cooking. Absolutely not. My mom was a terrible cook. And I think this is why I spent so much time in the kitchen, because she was so bad at cooking that I wanted to eat good food myself. I don't to eat something better.
Did your dad appreciate food, or is he just a more of a eat to live kind of a guy?
My dad appreciated food. It was actually himself cooking with me.
Really?
It was actually like pulling cookbooks and trying to do new recipes because
wow,
the and food that... we're eating was not that great. So,
so you were trying to improve your mother's cooking.
I was doing better than my mother's cooking.
When and where did you start working in food and why?
So when I was about 15 years old, this is the end of the legal age of like working in France, and you either decide to go university or you decide to get a job. And at the time, my parents didn't have any money to send me to school to pay for my education. So I found myself a job in a restaurant, and I was following a program of apprenticeship. So I was going to school at the same time I had a job. And I did this myself for like for 3 years, 2 years in a service section. So I was a chef, trained as a chef for 2 years, and then 1 year in pastry.
Wow. And then you said that you joined the army.
That's right. After this 3 years of learning how to bake and cook, the military service in France was still mandatory for me. So I decided to leave the country, kind of, and to go to French Guiana, which is in South America.
But so you weren't baking in the army.
I was in a kitchen. I was in the middle of a rainforest, in the middle of nowhere. I was cooking for 600 to 800 people every day.
Wow.
And I was actually a part of the program that was teaching local people on how to cook. And after this program, they were following with me. They'll get an official diploma from the military service, and they'll allow them to get a job.
Wow. So it was very much a pro-social kind of military service.
That was very, yeah.
Yeah, that's very unusual. Yeah. Mm. So, and how did you then make your way to Paris and Fauchon?
So after my military service, I had a plan just to go to Paris and find a job. Paris, for me, was the city of opportunity. And I had barely $2,000. That was my three years of savings. I decided to buy a tiny car. And I bought a small car that was a half broken.
It was a half broken car that is all you could afford. With you probably didn't spend all the $2,000.
No, I spent less. I spent less. I tried to save a little bit, and I print out resumes and I drove to Paris. At the time, of course, no GPS. No, I just had a map, paper map that was like an opening that was taking the whole half front, the size of the of
front
the,
seat
of the
yes.
front seat. And I drove to Paris without knowing where I was going. I was a young kid, completely lost.
And you didn't know anybody?
I didn't know anyone. And I dropped off maybe like 20, 25 resumes. Every time I would see a bakery or a pastry shop, I will stop the car and I will drop off resume and jump back in the car and drive. I did this for a week. I got maybe like 6 or 8 job offers. And I ended up working at Pelletier, which was one of the oldest pastry shop at the time in Paris. It's now closed. And after working for Pelletier for a year, I ended up just working by Fauchon. I had no idea what what it was, and I had no idea it was the best pastry shop in town. I just looked at the display and I thought it was beautiful. So I walk in with my resume and ask to see the chef. The manager at the time brought the resume to the chef. She asked me to come downstairs to meet him in his office. His office was super, super small. And I had an interview there, and he asked me to start on Monday, like 2 days later.
And so when you start at a place like that, are you given a station, and are you just, do you end up making 3,000 croissants a day? Or, I mean, what do you do?
So when I first started Fauchon, I was actually hired for the holidays. So during the holidays, they hire maybe 50% more employees. I was hired from September to December just to help with the increase of production. I was one of 30 people hired the same day.
Wow.
And they brought us into a room. The first day, they talked to all of us. They told us at the end of the 4 months, they will keep only 3 of us.
Those aren't good odds. You could apply to Harvard and have better odds of getting in.
Maybe. And after about 3.5 months, they called us all of us into the room again. And they told us they couldn't keep 3 people, but they will keep 1 only. And at the end of this time, they called me in the office and they told me that I was selected to stay with them.
Wow. Well, I mean, that somebody must have, you must have shown something to someone. If you were the only one they kept out of 30, were you aware that this was something that both gave you great pleasure and that you could be really good at?
Well, at the time, I was just working hard every day. I was...
So you were very single-minded.
Yes, I was pretty quick on my feet. I was listening very carefully. I was, very disciplined, clean, organized. And I was a young kid that was just working really hard every single day. I knew I had good chances to be hired, but I didn't know it was going to be me, to be honest. And I was actually surprised when they told me it was going to be me, because in my mind, I wasn't even sure if I wanted to stay or not.
Really?
So I decided to take the job. And I stayed for Fauchon for almost 8 years.
8 years, and you were the head dude. That's a French name. You were the head dude.
I was the corporate pastry chef in charge of the international development. So I was opening pastry shop for them around the world.
That's right, because they had a shop here for a while.
They had a shop in New York.
On Park Avenue.
That's right. I opened the shop in Kuwait, Egypt, Russia.
Wow.
So very exotic places for a young kid that travels. And, it was a very exciting time for me. I was keep on learning. I was growing with the company. I was working really hard.
That's great. And then out of the blue, you've told me, Daniel Boulou reached out to you and asked you to become the pastry chef at Daniel, even though, as you say in your book, you never had done one plated dessert in your entire life.
That's right. I mean, in 2006, Daniel Boulou called me. He's heard about me, about what I was doing in France, and he would try to see if I would be interested into moving to New York. At the time, of course, it sounded really exciting, and I took a chance to come to New York to meet him. I did a tasting for him. But I told him I don't have that much experience in a restaurant. I had worked in a restaurant before as a chef, as a savory chef, but I didn't do much
pastry
in plated dessert, in fine dining. And of course, he knew that I had skills, that I had techniques, a lot of techniques based on what I was doing at Fauchon, which is like creating new dishes, working with the production team. So I was very technical, very rounded skills when it comes to pastry. But I didn't have much experience in fine dining, plated dessert, which is a different feel from working in a bakery. And I did this thing for him. I did maybe 7 or 8 dishes. And after the second one, Daniel was seated. He looked at me. He was like, "So when can you start?"
That's pretty amazing. Because he has unbelievably high standards.
He does, yes.
He also knows what delicious is the way very few people do. And for him to do that after 2 desserts,
yeah,
maybe he's a pretty good talent scout.
Yeah, he's actually very talented to really like see talented people and get them to work with him.
Yeah.
He has like tons of chefs that work for Daniel in New York and around the world that are very successful businessmen now.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, like during this process, I felt like good, like working with Daniel, like right away. I knew what kind of person he was, and I knew that we had the same ambition. I said yes to the job offer, and 8 weeks later, I was in New York City with my two suitcases. I wrapped everything up in France, and that's what I had, two suitcases, an empty apartment in
Queens.
And the
only person you knew was Daniel.
The only person I knew was Daniel, yes.
You specialize into going to big cities and not knowing anybody.
I assume so, yes. But I found my way.
Yes, you certainly did. And then you went out on your own. Why? And what did Danielle say?
So I always had the ambition of opening my own business. I always thought that I had my own style. I saw things differently. The food, I thought of food differently. The way of eating, the way of presenting the food, the way of working with food. And before actually I opened the shop, when I gave my notice to Daniel, he was not really happy about it.
Oh, yes.
He was really not happy about it.
I know a lot of people who have given notice to Daniel, and he's not happy about any of them.
But I would say, you know, that my relationship with Daniel is more almost like a father and a son. Mm-hmm. And when you leave Daniel, he feels, you know, he feels sad about it.
Because he feels like he created a family and you're leaving the family.
Exactly. It's like watching your child leaving home and going on their own. You're kind of upset and you wish they stay with you. But I had to explain to Daniel that, you know, I was not going to work for anyone else, that I was going to open my own business. And after talking to him, like, he understood and he was very supportive.
That's great.
That's great. So I've always wanted to open my own shop. I always wanted to do things on my own. And I found a bakery on Spring Street. And I remember talking to people about what I wanted to do. And I've had lots and lots of people trying to give advice without me asking, telling me that I should do cupcakes and cheesecake. That's all that sells in New York, that people will not be ready for any kind of pastry shop. That I should be doing sandwiches for lunch because it's going to be most of my business. And at the time, this is actually a part of the book. I decided not to listen to anyone.
Yeah, and it's one of the things I wanted to talk to you. You had this chapter that's titled Learning Not to Listen.
It's called Don't Listen to Anyone. Don't Listen to Anyone. Sometimes I believe that when you, not being stubborn, but standing on your ground and believing in what you do and where you're going is very important, especially when you're creative, when you're a leader, when you're the first one to do something different. People always look at you saying, like, you're crazy.
The same thing happened to me with Serious Eats. You know, it was like, I remember Jeffrey Steingarten said to me, you're not going to do your stories for the Times anymore? Have you lost your mind? And a food writer I won't mention the name of asked me, oh yeah, you started one of those little things, didn't you?
And well, it's always start little, right?
Yes, and you're right. There's a certain kind of internal strength required not to listen, and it's hard in the beginning, especially when you're doing something that nobody else has done before.
It's very hard because the more you listen to people, and the more you doubt yourself. Into your ability of thinking out of the box, into your ability of like making it happen. But at the end, when I look back at what I've done and every step of the business, including the Cornut phenomena and what happened after that, I always know what's right and what's not. Because I always know what to do, what's a good thing to do for myself, for my customers, for the future of the business, for my integrity. I always know the right thing to do.
Because you had initial success in trusting your gut. It's really what it comes down to, right?
Exactly. And, you know, opening the bakery on Spring Street, I didn't know. I had four employees to open the shop. I had four employees. I had no idea I knew what I was doing, of course, but I had no idea, like, how much it would take. And I remember peeling off the paper from the window, opening the doors without any announcement, anything, anyone, and seeing like we had like six or seven people that walking the minute we opened the doors. And I always remember our first customers because he still comes to the shop all the time. His name is Mike.
That's
we
awesome.
Are doing his wedding cake this summer. He's passionate about the bakery. He comes to the kitchen all the time, and he's loyal, you know. And this is this kind of people that made the bakery by coming back every day, by being loyal customers, by believing in what I was doing, changing the menu, by coming back and being exciting about it. And those are my customers, the customers that makes the bakery every day. And when you see them, when you interact with them, when you talk to them, you can feel if you're doing the right thing or not.
Yeah. One of the things you and I talk about all the time, and you write a lot about in the book, is time and the role that time assumes in your pastries and in your creative process. You wrote in your book that we live in a world where every creation strives to be both instantaneous and eternal. To respect time as the supreme ingredient is a battle of breaking habits and changing perceptions. Nobody likes to wait. Nobody likes to rush. When you treat time as an ingredient, it changes everything.
Food is alive. Food is always alive. Sometimes the shelf life of some product, it might be like a few minutes. Sometimes it might be a couple hours. Sometimes it's better after a day or two. Food is alive, and you have to treat it the same way. At the bakery, we do fresh-baked madeleines. And the madeleines, you can get it anywhere, like any like coffee shop do madeleines. They put it in a cellophane bag. It's wrapped up. It's dry. It's like just a little piece of dough that's been cooked. Our madeleines are fresh-baked to order, meaning when you order madeleines at the bakery, you have to wait for it. It takes about 4 to 5 minutes to bake. They come out fresh out of the oven. That's the only way we sell it. We don't put it in a bag. We don't put it on the shelf. We bake them fresh to order. And when you bite into it, that's the experience, like really the essence of what good food is. It's warm. It's pillowy. It's fluffy. It's like this beautiful lemon flavor.
But it's in the moment.
It's in the moment. And, you know, it's this kind of food I grew up with. I grew up eating when I was a kid, going to the bakery like 3-4 times a day with my mom, my grandma, and buying like getting a baguette that was still like so hot, so I could barely hold it. And I was like biting into it, and the crunch and the steam and the smell. That's emotion. That's life.
Yeah.
And some of the pastry we bake, they have a shelf life that is very short.
Yeah.
The madeleine is one of them. The shelf life is just like 3-4 minutes. That's what
wow,
I tell people all the
crazy.
Time. I literally like bake the madeleines, hand it out to people, and tell them to eat now.
Wow.
And when they want to put it in the bag, I have to explain to them, like, please eat it now. That's the moment in time where they are the best, and that's the experience that
right.
you really give them, like of eating hot food, like fresh from the oven.
Yeah. You do so much stuff that's of the moment, right? Almost 70% of the second place you opened in New York, Dominique Ancel Kitchen, is the menu is comprised of things that are either assembled, finished, or made to order. That's a scary thing. It can't be comfortable.
I mean, our motto for our new shop, Dominique Ancel Kitchen, is time as an ingredient. It's actually got pulled from the book. I remember once giving a demo in a store and having starting like a little contest to see who could make the best cookie. I was demoing how to make a nice cookie, and I found it like interesting that in the beginning we only had like 2 or 3 people participating, and I was very worried. I was like, oh, like there's so many people that came to the demo, about like 50 to 60 people, but no one had entered into like this cookie contest to see who could do the best one. So I was a little bit sad about it, and after the demo, after almost an hour, we see like people rushing and running, and I was like, what's happening? And they were like about 12 to 15 people that had come out the last minute, the last 10 minutes, bringing fresh cookies, fresh baked cookies. This girl had made like fresh like spun vanilla ice cream to go with the cookies, and this is this moment where I realized that Yes, of course, you know.
They've internalized the lessons from you.
Not even. It's normal. It's normal that they believe a fresh baked cookie is better than a cookie that's been baked hours ago. Of course, we all grew up with this. You bake cookies at home with your mom, with your grandma. They're fresh from the oven. And of course, they taste better because they're fresh. And this is what we do at Dominican Style Kitchen. 70% of our menu is made to order. So think of, for example, we have a lemon tart that is made with yuzu and lemon. Yuzu is Japanese citrus, so it's a combination of two citrus. And we emulsify the curd to order. So we emulsify the curd with the butter in a milkshake maker.
In a milkshake maker?
In a milkshake maker.
Okay, can I say this? You're insane, dude.
Because the blade is very, very fast and emulsified in a texture that's super smooth, super creamy.
I've had it.
I've had it very light. We have this like very thin tart shell that is like crunchy and vanilla-y, and we pour the lemon curd onto the tart shell, and that we add a little bit of lemon zest, and that's it. Simplicity, texture, freshness, and we guarantee like a unique experience.
But you make it sound so easy and that it's so comfortable. And yet in the book, you talk about the role that discomfort plays in creativity.
I mean, there's always things that people like and dislike. For me, for example, like I really find that when people tell you it's going to be hard, it's impossible, it's going to be like, you know, something that won't work. I found myself like really excited about making it work and proving a point that, you know, we can make it happen. This is why, for example, at the kitchen is not designed like any other bakery. It's a bakery that's designed almost like a service kitchen, like a restaurant, and it's still a retail shop. So we organized a station with an expediter station, with a hotline, a call line, and then we have all the food coming together. So where people were telling me that it's not going to work, that it's impossible, I mean, this kind of bakeries are does not exist.
Right, because normally bakeries have assembly lines, essentially.
Exactly. Everything is done at night. Everything is put in on the shelf or in display overnight, and that's it. There's nothing else. And when you come in, either it's 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 p.m. at night, you have the same food. You eat the same food. At Dominican Style Kitchen, we make everything fresh for you to order. So it's you know, it's a unique experience. It's really, I always compare to like sushi. It's like buying sushi, putting in your fridge for like a day and then eating it versus going to a sushi restaurant, having the chef preparing the food for you and eating it right away on the spot. Of course it's going to taste better. It makes sense, of course. Who wants to eat a lemon tart that stays in the fridge for like hours and it's all dry and set with gelatin? Of course you want a lemon tart that's creamy, smooth, just emulsified to order, and it takes you somewhere like really special where you probably never experienced.
How do you find people that are comfortable with discomfort to work there?
I mean, everyone always had some discomfort. The most important for me is to train. Training people is something that is a big part of our culture. Training people to get better, training people to think differently when it comes to food. So many young chefs, including myself, when I was younger, like are told to replicate the food and to produce, and that's it. People should be told on how to create and how to think differently out of the box, but not just like to replicate recipe. Of course, it's good. It's very important to have good base when it comes to food. Of course, it's strong. It's important to be strong with techniques, but also it's also important to learn how to be creative. And this is what I teach my team. This is what a lot of people should know. It's a different culture when it comes to food.
And part of creativity is not knowing what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And being comfortable with that.
Yes, it's a little bit tricky, especially when you talk about pastry, because pastry is very scientific.
And very precise.
And very precise. So it's very meticulous. You have to scale everything. You have to measure everything. The proper temperature, the proper places. And it's a little bit, it throws off a lot of people, because sometimes you have to try things that you've been told not to do, to experiment, to see the reaction, to really go out of your way to make things happen.
Let's talk about innovation. I'm fascinated by the way tradition and innovation intersect in your work. And in the book, you say that real innovation is not about chasing the fashionable, but having an inherent beauty. It is not about a sampling of cleverness, but honest consideration for what works well. And the example you give for innovation is vanilla ice cream. And I thought that was so interesting because on the face of it, it's absurd. But when you think about what you said about innovation, it actually makes sense.
That's right. When was the last time you had a good vanilla ice cream? Or have you ever had a good vanilla ice cream? It's not a silly question. It's really like if you think to yourself, have I ever had a great vanilla ice cream?
Maybe at your
when
place.
When I eat it.
Could be at your
place. I
hope
so. When you bite into it, when you have a spoon, you're like, oh my God, it really tastes like vanilla. It's really creamy. It's really like those flavors. And the flavor of vanilla is very complex. It's floral. It's sometimes fruity. It's very soft. It's rounded. It's rich. And when was the last time you had real vanilla? You know, you have vanilla in like so many products in everywhere in the industrial production. Like real vanilla, the one I buy, is coming from Tahiti. Tahiti vanilla is one of the best. It's like rich. There's tons of seeds. The flavors is amazing. It's really expensive. It's really rare, but it's a great quality product. And when you eat my vanilla ice cream, like hopefully you remember it and you remember like being something that you probably or maybe never tried before.
It sounds like you want the experience to be like, oh, this is what vanilla ice cream is supposed to taste like.
Yes, probably.
So you say this about creativity and you are a compulsively creative person. There's a fear we won't ever come across anything as good that we make, that we'll end up being a one-hit wonder. Have a little faith in yourself. It's not about releasing one idea into the world, but embracing idea generation as a lifestyle. Ideas must be seen, heard, touched, and tasted to become real. Let them live. Otherwise, they are merely ghosts in our head. I think the key that I took away from it is this notion of having faith that their other ideas will appear.
That's right. After the Cronut, you know, after the Cronut craze and people talking about it, it was very overwhelming. And I told myself that, I promised myself that I will never stop creating, that the Cronut was a beautiful creation, that it opened so many doors, but that was not it. There was more to bring. And this is when I created the Frozen S'mores.
Which is a beautiful thing.
The frozen s'mores is an ice cream version of a s'mores. So think of a cube of vanilla ice cream, a cover with a chocolate wafer, and wrap around with a honey marshmallow. This is served on a branch that's been smoked with apple wood, and it's torched to order. So the outside of the marshmallow create this like thin, almost like creme brulee, caramelized crust. When you bite into it, it's crunchy, it's warm, it's chewy, it's cold, it's vanilla-y. And it smells like campfire. It's this mix of emotions that goes through your mind and your body. And this is what I call a beautiful creation as well. Because
that's what you live for.
Exactly. But you see this kind of emotions. I didn't grow up with it. I didn't grow up eating s'mores. When I came to America, I had no idea what a s'mores was. And I've learned about it. I listened to it. I tried to really like feel what people like and why they liked it, and I created the frozen s'mores, and was a way for me to really connect with people. I always say that good food is food that you remember. Emotions and memory is connected to like good food. And if you remember when you were a child eating those like fresh baked cookies, why were they so good? Because they're warm, they're fresh from the oven, because they smell so good. And it's, you know, those emotions that you remember.
And that's what you're trying to connect with.
Exactly. So it's not something that is like you've never seen before. It's a version of a s'mores, but it's an ice cream version. It looks like it. It smells like it. It tastes like it. But it's an ice cream. So it brings you back a lot of emotions, a lot of childhood emotions, to a place where maybe you were with friends, family, to a place where you remember having a good time, being with people whom you love and really capture this moment of emotion, being around a campfire, doing s'mores with the family, with the friends.
And so it's really a matter of the traditions that you're observing are really emotional traditions.
Exactly. There's no creating food just to try to be creative. Really, if people don't understand your food, you miss something really big. People have to connect with your food. They have to understand it. If tomorrow I create something, a crazy pastry that no one's heard of, that has like tradition of a different country, a different place, and no one relate to, you're not going to be excited about it. You're not going to want to learn about it. It's going to taste good. Yes, maybe. But it's not going to be this amazing creation, because if I don't connect with people, if I don't understand why I created this product and what I was trying to accomplish, they're not going to like it.
Yeah.
So emotions is something very important for me. Emotions is connected to memories, and memories is connected with good food.
Yeah. You're a Frenchman that learned your craft in France and rose to the top at Fauchon. And then you came to New York and you were the pastry chef at Daniel. And now you have two places in New York, but you're now crossing oceans again, right? You opened a shop in Tokyo.
That's right.
And you're about to open one in London this year, mm-hmm. later this year. I mean, what's that all about? And is it the same, or do you have to reimagine a Dominique Ancel bakery in those places?
The menu, for example, in Tokyo is similar to the menu on Spring Street in New York, but it has like 35 to 40% of the creations are dedicated to local culture, to local ingredients, to local tradition, to the local people, the people that come and come back every day, the same way we did it in New York, but it's adapted to the culture in Tokyo.
And how do the Japanese, how are they responding?
They're loving it. It's amazing. The team there is doing a great job. We have a beautiful shop. There's lines every single day in Tokyo.
Is there has a Japanese equivalent of the cronut?
I mean, in Tokyo they have the cronut, of course. The flavors are actually using local ingredients. For example, we used milk from Hokkaido and local honey a few months ago. We use matcha. We use azuki, which is a red bean paste. We use a lot of local ingredients. It's still like very tasty, very very interesting flavors. But we use local product. At the same time, we have some addition to the menu. One is called the Paris Tokyo. It's based on the Paris Brest, the French classic. In New York, we do Paris New York. In Tokyo, we do Paris Tokyo. The Paris Tokyo is a ring of cream puff with green tea cream, vanilla, and a little bit of passion fruit. So this is one of our signature in Tokyo, and it's doing amazing.
Wow, that's great. And are you going to do the same things in London?
We're going to do the same thing in London. Tokyo, we also created this, for the cherry blossom, we created this hot chocolate with a marshmallow flour, where when you drop the marshmallow in the hot chocolate, it opens up and blossoms like a flower.
Come on.
So this is amazing. This is really beautiful. People are raving about it, and it's becoming one of our bestsellers right now. In London, I'm thrilled to get there, to get to know a little bit more about the culture, about the British tradition and the British pastries, which are not as popular as the rest of like French pastry, for
right.
example.
Sure.
But there's a lot like culturally that I'm learning about to play with and to see if we can do something unique there.
So I have one more question before we're going to get to the 5-minute special sauce, all you can say buffet. And that is, and I'm embarrassed to say that you've invited me many times, but I haven't been to the tasting dinners that you do on the second floor of the kitchen, of the Dominique Ancel kitchen. And they all have a theme, right? And again, I'm now, as we're talking, I'm realizing that they're all related to emotions, you know, that the themes are not cultural, they're really emotional and psychological.
That's right. So we have a chef tasting table on the second floor of our kitchen. It's called UP, and it stands for Unlimited Possibilities. It's our chef testing menu where we only have 8 seats. We have a table that hangs on the ceiling of our kitchen.
I've seen it.
That drops down from the ceiling. So we clean up the entire kitchen. We push the chair. We push the chair in the middle of the kitchen. And there we have 8 courses of desserts that are really exciting. The menu is called American Dreams, our new menu. And it takes you back to a century of American Dream. And this is a way of interpreting the American dreams through food. So the first course, for example, it's called Eureka, and so it's a gold rush, and we serve you like 2 little nuggets of gold that you have in a sift that you have to pan for, and you bite into those 2 little nuggets. One is made with acacia honey, and the other one with sourdough, and it's all those dishes are very interactive. They take you back in time. They bring you emotions and take you through memories, and it's very interactive.
And you change that menu every.
We change this menu every 6 months or so. The first menu was called First, and it retraces all the first time of someone's life. So
first kiss, first
exactly,
whatever.
Exactly, first word, first kiss, first time living on your own, the first job. And it's really
first
a
time you go to a city where you don't know anybody.
Not this one, but you know, it's really a way for people to open conversation, to think about food differently, but also to remember food. I've been to so many tasting menu where after like 20, 25 courses, you really don't remember half of what you ate.
Sure.
Even the next day, even the same night. And to me, it's very important that people remember, and through those stories that we tell, hopefully people remember all of the dishes they eat that night.
So, all right, now it's time for the buffet. So what's in your desert island fridge? There's electricity on your desert island. So I just want to know 5 things that are in your fridge.
5 things?
Yeah, 5 items.
We'll say water.
Water, okay.
Sorry, it's boring, but
yeah, that's boring. You need better. We need to do better than water.
Butter, sugar, and flour.
What? Butter, sugar, and flour. You're a pastry chef. See, that makes sense.
Could do something with that.
Yes. And you could do a lot of things with that.
Maybe a beer.
A beer. All
nice
right.
Nice and refreshing.
And one more thing.
Maybe just milk.
Just milk.
Yeah.
Cold milk.
Cold milk, yeah.
Cold whole milk.
Exactly. That sounds good. Yeah. Cold whole milk.
Cold whole milk's a really good thing. So who's at your last supper? No, no family allowed.
Who's
could
my
be
last
anybody.
Supper?
Yeah, it could be anybody you admire.
You?
All right, that's always a good start, as far as I'm concerned. But it's not necessary. You don't have to butter me up. No pun intended.
That's a good one.
But
I think I'll invite Daniel Boudou.
Okay.
He's always a lot of fun.
He is, and and the man likes to party.
Oh, my God. You can't stop him.
Yes, I've seen that. Who else?
I invite Danny Meyer.
Danny Meyer. All mm-hmm. right. It's a very foodie-oriented
yes.
thing.
Yes. Well, this is what I do for a living, so.
But all right. So 2 more people.
Two more people.
And they can't be food people.
President Obama.
Okay.
Because why not, right?
Yeah. Go choose. For it. That's awesome.
And one more?
Yeah. I could give you the easy out. You could say Michelle Obama.
I was about to, but it'll be okay. Michelle Obama, I guess.
All right. So what are you eating at the Last Supper?
What are you eating? Something simple. Good omelette, a nice salad, some fresh tomatoes. Just simple and tasty.
I know what I would be eating, or what you should be eating for dessert, is that pavlova, whatever it is that you brought to the studio.
Beautiful pavlova.
With these beautiful strawberries from Spain.
That's right.
And I'd never tasted anything like it. So can you make sure that that's on the menu, especially if you want me to come?
I'll invite you. I'll make sure we have it.
So all right, that's good.
We made this beautiful pavlova with the wild strawberries. This little woodland strawberries that are flown overnight from Malaga, Spain. And it's just a beautiful mascarpone vanilla cream with a nice crunchy and soft pavlova meringue. and this perfect strawberries. You can describe it. It tastes like little, like candy. They're very tiny. They are very floral. And it's one of my favorite for the summer. It's very simple, but super tasty.
It's perfect. This is a fun question to ask you, because your life is full of guilty pleasures. You're surrounded by guilty pleasures. What guilt? That's true. So is there something off the shelf that you don't have to feel guilty about it, but is there something off the shelf that you would grab?
I actually like candies once in a while.
What kind? I need a specific candy.
I like M&M's.
M&M's plain or peanut?
Peanut.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a controversial choice, you know.
Why is it?
Because all the M&M freaks I know, including a lot of pastry chefs and savory chefs, swear by M&M plains, and they think that M&M peanuts are beside the point.
Well, you know me. I'm different.
All right, that's good. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Dominique Ancel. You can line up for a cronut at his shop in New York City's Soho. You can travel to Tokyo. Maybe the line won't be as long. And starting sometime late this year, you'll be able to get a cronut in London. But I don't think you should wait to go to get a cronut, because there are so many other seriously delicious things to be had at Dominique Ancel Bakery and Dominique Ancel Kitchen in New York, and I'm sure at the bakeries in Tokyo and soon to be London. And by all means, get yourself a copy of Dominique Ancel, The Secret Recipes. It is a really spectacular book. Not only are the photos incredible, but it's a book, I think I once told you that I always judge cookbooks by whether I would love them without the recipes. And your book, I truly enjoy reading without the recipes. So anyway, thank you, Dominique, and thank you, Serious Eaters, for listening. And until next time on Special Sauce.
Thank you very much.